Following are comments on William Shakespeare's King Lear, Act 3. I am a man more sinned against than sinning. King Lear rages in the storm. In Act 3, Scene 1, King Lear is determined to confront the howling rage within himself, and at times he sounds like the biblical Job making impassioned demands of God. Lear confronts an external world, too, that seems to have turned against him and that represents everything beyond himself that he cannot control. So the storm is both, and at the same time, a real storm and a metaphor for a man's internal discord. Kent's concern about Lear's isolation under the quote-unquote fretful elements isn't about grand political theory or power. It's about who is tending to the frail old man. He should not be left alone. Act 3, Scene 1, Line 4. In a less tragic universe, this concern would be the beginning of a restoration, but not in this play's world. A gentleman says that the only person watching over Lear is the fool, and he, quote-unquote, labors to outjest his heart-struck injuries. Act 3, Scene 1, Lines 9 through 10. The fool is trying to distract the troubled king with jokes, but it's hard going. By Act 3, Scene 2, what can we tell from Lear's raging in the storm? We know that King Lear, the play, is in part a tragedy of growing old and being unable to deal with the changes and the loss that inevitably come. Lear's daughters have long represented perpetuity to him, and he remains obsessed with their betrayal. To the storm, he says, quote-unquote, I tax not you, you elements, with unkindness. I never gave you kingdom, called you children. Act 3, Scene 2, Lines 16 through 17. Lear's present unhappy relationship with his daughters weighs heavily on him at all times. He can't escape it. Lear's rage also takes aim at the, quote-unquote, great gods that keep this dreadful putter o'er our heads. Act 3, Scene 2, Lines 49 through 50. His insight is summed up in the confident claim, quote-unquote, I am a man more sinned against than sinning. Act 3, Scene 2, Lines 59 through 60. At base, the question that emerges here has to do with justice, with equity, whether we're talking about humans relating to humans or humans relating to the gods. Lear has done serious wrong, but has the wrong he's done merited the cold-hearted betrayal he is experiencing? He is certain that it has not. With the realization that he is quote-unquote, more sinned against than sinning, Lear claims that his, quote-unquote, wits begin to turn, and he appears to be freed up to show compassion for the suffering poor Tom. Act 3, Scene 2, Line 67. He won't yet take shelter, but in principle, he accepts the generous offer, saying, quote-unquote, come, your hovel. Act 3, Scene 2, Line 71. In Act 3, Scene 3, Gloucester says he will provide what help he can to Lear. And he expresses support for the coming French invasion led by Cordelia and the King of France. As the third act progresses, Gloucester is again betrayed by Edmund and delivered to the most evil agents in the play, who will soon deal with him in the cruelest possible manner. Edmund, by contrast, is made Earl of Gloucester in his father's place, and his callous reaction to this triumph is, quote-unquote, the younger rises when the old doth fall. Act 3, Scene 3, Line 22. Thou art the thing itself. King Lear meets Edgar as poor Tom. In Act 3, Scene 4, Lear at first seems to think he will use the storm to meditate on, quote-unquote, filial ingratitude. Act 3, Scene 4, Line 15. But more importantly, it allows him to make contact with his own and another man's common humanity. This is when he meets poor Tom. Lear is convinced by Edgar's madman act and says to him, quote unquote, "Thou art the thing itself. Unaccommodated man is no more, but such a poor, bare, forked animal as thou art." Act 3, Scene 4, lines 96 through 98. What the king is actually looking at is Edgar's performance art, not the thing itself. As mentioned in my commentary on Act 2, Dr. Daniel Mason writes in his December 2014 article, Tom of Bedlam, in the American Journal of Psychiatry, Volume 171, Number 12, that it was not unknown for citizens to encounter beggars falsely claiming to have been released from St. Mary of Bethlehem Asylum, or Bedlam. Mason suggests further, quote unquote, "Edgar, rather than just playing a madman, was playing a man playing a madman." That's an excellent observation. At the same time, this layered artistic trick moves King Lear to recognize something real about human suffering. That realization is what matters most. Right after King Lear meets and speaks with poor Tom, the fool convinces him to take shelter at last. The fool understands intuitively that the king must return to a more accommodated model of humanity, so that he can survive rather than be destroyed, crushed by the dreadful forces he is partly responsible for unleashing. Those forces are moving fast, since in the brief Act 3, Scene 5 that follows, Edmund implicates his father Gloucester in the French preparations to help the king, and is rewarded by Cornwall with the alderman's title. Is there any cause in nature that makes these hard hearts? Lear puts Regan and Goneril on mock trial, in absentia. In Act 3, Scene 6, we come to the trial scene. This mock trial of Regan and Goneril is inconclusive as justice goes, with no sentence meted out, but its most significant point comes when Lear says, quote unquote, "Then let them anatomize Regan, see what breeds about her heart. Is there any cause in nature that makes these hard hearts?" Act 3, Scene 6, lines 34 through 36. The king's horror at a cruelty beyond what he had thought possible wells up. As the trial ends, Edgar, as a judge, along with Kent as Caius, realizes that he needs to put his poor Tom disguise behind him, and the fool utters his final line, quote unquote, "And I'll go to bed at noon." Act 3, Scene 6, line 42. He has done what he can, and Gloucester conducts Lear to shelter. "Because I would not see thy cruel nails pluck out his poor old eyes." With Regan's encouragement, Cornwall gouges out Gloucester's eyes and is himself mortally wounded by a servant. In Act 3, Scene 7, Cornwall, Regan, and Goneril know that Gloucester is a partisan on the old king's side and a welcomer of the French invasion by Cordelia and her husband, the King of France. These malefactors reserve their worst cruelty for the disfavored earl. For Shakespeare, it isn't enough to report the action of this terrible scene, the way the ancient Greek tragedians would have done. Even Seneca, author of a number of violent revenge dramas, would probably have reported or narrated this degree of graphic violence rather than staging it directly. Shakespeare, by contrast, stretches the bounds of aesthetic propriety to the tension level of modern theater of cruelty to get the point across that this is how low humanity can sink. Just in case we weren't certain, here it is in front of us. We like to think of tragedy as a philosophical genre, as an art form that lets us meditate on the worst of misfortunes, and yet leave the theater strangely uplifted. Quote unquote, "Calm of mind, all passion spent," as Milton's narrator says in Samson Agonistes. In the Poetics, after all, Aristotle had written that we delight in seeing representations of things that would certainly not please us if we believed they were real, and he put this tendency down to his claim that imitation, so-called, or representation, is how children learn their first lessons in life. Samuel Johnson later wrote much the same thing in his preface to Shakespeare, quote unquote, "The delight of tragedy proceeds from our consciousness of fiction. If we thought murders and treasons real, they would please no more." But in King Lear, Shakespeare is concerned to do something scandalously modern and cinematic. He aims to show even more than to tell. That's how important the point to be made about the depths of human depravity must have been to him. Still, he was an Elizabethan Jacobean playwright, so telling has a strong role to play as well. In the episode we are covering, Gloucester reaches a point in his interrogation where he has no choice but to declare his opposition to Cornwall, Regan, and Goneril. When asked why he has acted as he has, the Earl says courageously, quote unquote, "Because I would not see thy cruel nails pluck out his poor old eyes, nor thy fierce sister in his anointed flesh stick boorish fangs." Act 3, Scene 7, lines 56 through 58. To Gloucester, this word picture represents the worst thing he can imagine. It is a purely figurative, hypothetical expression. Not so for Regan, who has been interrogating him. Neither for Goneril, who, before departing to search for Gloucester, had uttered her preference prior to the current exchange. Quote unquote, "Pluck out his eyes." Act 3, Scene 7, Line 5. To Regan, Goneril, and Cornwall, the literal punishment of eye gouging seems appropriate. It is imaginable, sayable, and seamlessly doable. When Cornwall says, quote unquote, "Out, vile jelly, where is thy luster now?" we have reached the lowest point of depravity in the play. Act 3, Scene 7, lines 83 through 84. As Gloucester realizes he has wronged Edgar and let himself be duped by Edmund, Cornwall, mortally wounded, still finds a moment to exult over the man he has blinded with all the cruelty towards the disabled that the Elizabethans could muster. Quote unquote, "Turn out that eyeless villain." Act 3, Scene 7, line 97. This dreadful scene, during which Gloucester is blinded on stage, reminds us that the tragic mode often entails giving us an image, or what Sir Philip Sidney, in the more uplifting context of his defensive poesy, would call a, quote unquote, "speaking picture." But here, of the worst tendencies of humanity, and the wretched actions that result from those tendencies. Whether an aesthetic production can ever justify life's miseries or not, the opportunity to represent the unbearable is valuable. Aesthetic productions open up a space for contemplation and reflection. There are certainly risks involved in such a gesture, but there are rewards too, the attainment of insight being chief among them. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Wednesday, July 9th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare's third edition, four-volume, genre-based format.